Good morning again and greetings from New Jersey, the University Hospital, also known as University of Medicine and Dentistry, or UMDNJ. First, before I continue, I need to say that there's no relationships to disclose. What made me want to do this kind of study? I was always interested in why some African American women would quit smoking during pregnancy or cut back, and then in the postpartum period, they would restart to smoke again, and there was no follow-up. We have no protocol in place at the hospital to monitor these women. So they come back again pregnant, and they would say, well, I did stop during the first pregnancy, but then I started to smoke again, and now I'm pregnant again. I quit, or I'm cutting back. So what are some of the factors that influence smoking initiation? If you can see Virginia Slims, a slim girl on the box, that tells me if I smoke, maybe after I get that baby, I'm going to reduce and I'm going to look slim. Health beliefs, living environment, a partner smoking, everybody in the house smokes, so you know it's okay if I smoke. Limited education. And again, the media influence of tobacco advertisement, black and mild, that's a new cigarette, and the way they would say it, black and mild. So you smoke a lot because you're thinking it's mild, black and mild. Some more background and significance. We know smoking is a major cause of coronary heart disease among women, and the risk increases with cigarette smoke. Then there's the incidence of secondhand smoking in children, and SIDS, it's very big. Now just look at the statistics. Even though in 2003, it's 1.97, opposed to 0.10 in Caucasian women. 2002, it was high, but just look at SIDS in Caucasian infants, 0.2. And this just shows, in the United States, just look at the percentage, 12.6%. New Jersey, 10.3%. And if you look at the cigarette smoking by race, ethnicity, age, and education, blacks, African-American women, high, very high in New Jersey. Now, the purpose for me to do this was to test the efficacy of an individualized supportive intervention to see how I can help to reduce the postpartum smoking relapse in African-American women. So my problem statement, the objectives, I wanted to compare the differences in stages of smoking cessation between the two groups. And I also wanted to compare the differences in the intention of staying smoking free between these two groups. The literature review. What was most interesting, I used about 80 to 100 citations, and only 8 studies actually dealt with African American women. So we need a lot of research in this area. And low-income smokers may have lower access to the pharmacotherapy and other treatments that improve the cessation. And again, the underutilization of nurses in the treatment of smoking cessation. And the same variables that influence smoking cessation and postpartum relapse in the general population, like nicotine, addiction levels, it's the same that influence the African-American women. And what was interesting, too, is that most of the studies have highlighted that breastfeeding reduces the rate of relapse. I'm also the lactation consultant and education specialist. So while I was doing my research, my breastfeeding rates went up, which was good. Now, the studies have shown that postpartum relapse can begin as early as 2 weeks. But what was very interesting in my study, it began the same day. Now, there are some smoking prevention strategies that was used in all the other studies, like individual counseling, educational materials, and interventions that combine both counseling and education have been promising. The model that was used is the model of intentional behavioral change, also known as the trans-theoretical model. And there are 4 parts to it: stages of change, process of change, self-efficacy, and decisional balance. For my study, I focused on the stages of change. And that's the first stage, the woman has no intention to stop smoking. The second stage, I'm thinking about stopping, maybe in the next 6 months. The third stage, preparation, probably within a month I will stop. And the maintenance is, but I did not smoke for a month, 30 plus days. It was a quasi-experimental study design, and my data was obtained by, I had two structured questionnaires. One was dealing with the demographic variables, and it contained information about the participant themselves, like their smoking history and the secondhand smoke exposure. This study took place at my hospital, University Hospital, well, not my hospital, the hospital I worked at, New Jersey. And it was over a 5-month period, and I used 10, I had 10 patients. And they came from the postpartum floor and labor and delivery. My inclusion criteria, obviously, was African-American women, ages 18 to 40. And they had to self-report giving up smoking during their pregnancy. They had to receive care at the hospital and delivered within the hospital. My exclusion criteria, patients with no prenatal care who had a fetal demise. Someone had asked me why the patient with a fetal demise. But if you've just lost your baby, to be pressuring you as to be asking these questions is like, it's not fair to me. I've already lost my baby, you know. I probably don't mind having some information on smoking cessation, but it's like bothersome to keep asking about how much cigarettes you smoke, who's smoking your family when I'm grieving. So now my instrument, the first was the status of smoking cessation questionnaire, and I was just asking you, are you seriously thinking of quitting smoking? It would either be, I am not sure, or maybe next month, or, and those are the stages that we do have here. And the intention of staying smoking free is, what's your intention to permanently stay free? 1 to 4, like very much want to stay smoking free, or I really don't want to. My procedure, the women in the experimental group, they were followed up, they had their, while they were in the hospital, they were given all the information about smoking cessation, and then they were followed up by phone calls 7 to 10 days, and then in 4 weeks. And during each phone call, the stages of smoking cessation and the intention of staying smoking free, they were assessed. And then stage match counseling was provided. The strategies, the 3 A's. You will ask about the smoking status, and you identify your stage. Then you advise her to quit. And it's good to ask her to set a quick date. And sometimes asking that, you can say, when is your husband's birthday? When is your baby's birthday? And that relates to them. They'd say, well, you know what? I'll probably do it on my anniversary. You give them something. They're themselves going to come up with that date. But you don't want to, like, pressure them into saying, you must set that date tomorrow, because they're not going to do it. And then you assess the patient's intention of staying smoking free. And when advising the mother to quit, you have to use the 5 R's. Is there relevance to quitting? You're going to breathe healthier. You're not going to get, you know, cancer. You're going to be fine. You're going to save money. Cigarettes cost money. Rewards for not smoking. And you try to find what are the roadblocks. And you repeat the 5 R's just to aid in their success to quit smoking. Now the control group, they received information on quitting smoking along with standard care, and then the end of 4 weeks, then they were assessed, and if necessary, the referral. Data was coded and analyzed using the Statistical Package for Social Sciences, the SPSS as known, and then descriptive statistics were used to calculate demographic variables and major variables. The chi-square tests were used to assess both of my hypotheses. Now, this was the study participants' demographics, the number of children, years of education, employment, household income. And what was, you know, astonishing about this study, too, while doing the literature review, it was shown that most women with less than $15,000 annual income would resume smoking. And in both groups, all 5 patients were less than 5, their household income, less than 15,000. And the quitting, the number of times quitting, this is the smoking history before pregnancy. Some smoked 1 to 2, some 3 to 4, some a whole pack, some 6 to 10. And the number of times quitting, some people may say, I tried 2 times, so I might not try again, or I tried 3 times. But according to the literature review and according to evidence, some people, it takes some people 5 to 6 times to actually quit. And the status of smoking cessation between the two groups. If you notice in the, when you ask them, are you gonna quit smoking? Both groups, they weren't sure. They said, I don't know. But by the end of the study, if you can see in the maintenance section, both groups, most of them moved towards the maintenance section. The summary. Even though there was no statistical differences in the stages of smoking cessation and the intention of staying smoking free between these groups, and that was based on the chi-square test of association, the results were clinically meaningful. Because participants, as I just said, in the experimental group, they had moved towards the maintenance stage of smoking cessation, and they did demonstrate stronger intention of smoking cessation from the very first follow-up. And people change their behavior in different stages. And if we can get them to breastfeed during the postpartum period, can prevent smoking relapse. Because another interesting thing is, when they stop smoking or they say they quit during pregnancy, they're thinking about the baby, it's not themselves. And we talk about the health belief, because if I smoke during my first pregnancy and here is my child, no problems, she's probably, you know, going to college and everything is fine. How dare you say that it's wrong? Because this is evidence. My cousin smoked, my mother smoked, my sister smoked, and I'm standing here, I'm not sick. So the limitations. The findings of this study, it was limited because of my small sample size and the time in which I had to do the behavioral follow-up. So I'm suggesting, and I guess I probably can at some later stage, the replication for this study using a larger sample size population and from diverse hospitals, because I use my hospital, it's in a city, but it was just coming from my hospital. I'm saying my again, sorry. Hence generalization of the findings is limited. So nursing implications. Nursing administration, they need to have a protocol in place to follow up patients with a smoking history for at least 2 months. As I said before, when we're doing our questionnaire, because I was a nurse and now I'm in a different position, but we usually ask the questions, do you smoke? How many cigarettes do you smoke? Who else smoked in the house with you? And then where does the information go? It gets lost. There's no follow-up, but we ask these questions, we faithfully ask and we tick it off, and then with a chart review, they come back to make sure you didn't document this. But then what happens afterwards? There's no follow-up. And the nurses need to be trained in the treatment of smoking cessation, because according to Dunphy, brief interventions, they're very effective compared to no treatment. Nurses are the first line of defense. You're admitting the patient, you're talking to the patient. You're asking all these questions about smoking. At that time, if you are educated on smoking cessation, you can actually talk to your patient and give that patient, you know, information or referral if necessary. So smoking relapse intervention should start on admission and not at discharge. It's not started on admission. We're very good as, you know, the healthcare field in collecting information. What do we do with the data? How is the data disseminated? How do we act after? Is there any follow-up? So the protocol. I know the nurses are saying that I'm bringing more work into the field since I'm not like nurse anymore, and I'm just, they're saying it's more work you have for us. But when the patient comes to the hospital, as usual, we document the smoking history, and you evaluate that patient's stage of smoking cessation. And you use the 3 R's, ask about cigarette smoking advice, and you make sure that the 5 R's are used. Then in 7 to 10 days, counsel via phone. Document smoking history. When you go to the same day surgery, you have a procedure, and there's some hospitals that do this too. You have a call back. How are you doing? Are you taking your medication? Is there any problem? So we can call back. 4 weeks, nurse counsels via phone. Stage match counseling, individual support is given. And then at the end, in 8 weeks, referral if necessary. Now, the stages of change intervention, stages of smoking cessation. Remember, the pre-contemplation stage, she has no intention of stop smoking. So don't matter what you say to me, I know I'm not going to stop smoking. But I'm listening. So you try to explore the concerns about health and the benefits of quitting smoking and the information on secondhand smoking. Because it is documented that for every $1 invested in smoking cessation efforts, $6 being saved in the neonatal and intensive care treatment. So the contemplation stage, I am thinking about stopping smoking probably within the next 6 months. Identify barriers. What is preventing you? What are some of the roadblocks? Who smokes in the house? Can you ask that person to smoke outside the house? Can you get rid of all the ashtrays and the cigarette butts in the house? Can you, and then you give information on the consequences of smoking. This is the time when you're gonna say, you know, women are dying of lung cancer, and it may not happen to you tomorrow, but because you're continuing smoking, it means that the problem can become a serious problem, and you need to stop smoking. You'll breathe easier, you'll save money, put the money aside, that child can go to college, and you help them to overcome temptations. Exercise, find a support group. Well, I did say remove tobacco products from the environment and help to set a quick date. It's amazing when you have a communication, when you have that rapport with your patient, the stuff they say to you. One patient said, I don't really want to smoke, but sometimes I turn the TV on and I see people smoking and I just smoke a cigarette. Some people say when I'm in the bathroom, that's the only time I go nurse. How many times I go to the bathroom? And the preparation, they're thinking about stopping smoking. Seriously, they're gonna say, you know what? I'll stop next month. No, I'm serious, nurse, I'll stop next month. So you reinforce the benefits of quitting. Help to set a quick date. Help to identify and utilize support persons. Find out who are some of the friends that don't smoke. Get their numbers, call them. Take the children out to go for a walk. Do something rather than when you're alone and you're just thinking, well, there's nothing to do, let me just smoke a cigarette. Use of the quit lines and the maintenance. When they say, I haven't smoked for 30 days, you can say yippee, but it's not the end. You give support, identify rewards, but you have to encourage them to have a list of support persons. And they need to use the support groups. Conclusion. The study findings have supported the theoretical framework that people change their behavior in different stages. You cannot say, stop smoking, and they say to you, I will tomorrow. It's not going to happen. It's stepwise. It occurs incrementally. And it also shows that relapse is associated with personal factors, stress, coping with the new baby. The patient that smoked the same day that she came home, she said, it was my first baby, and when I came home, everything looked so different, but the only thing that, you know, helped me is lighting up the cigarette. But I didn't smoke the whole cigarette. And sometimes friends and partners smoking in the house in the same environment, it's not good. Because if you come into the house and there's a cigarette here, the ashtray is here, somebody's smoking, or if people know that it's okay to come and smoke in the house, that's not gonna be helpful. So if this protocol is implemented, this approach, I think it has the potential to achieve reduction in poor maternal, infant, and pregnancy outcomes, thereby reducing associative excessive health care costs. That's the end, and questions and answers time.
At this time, we can open questions to all three presenters.
We asked them in terms of getting medications from you know, what medications has the child been on, and then what pharmacies they used. But I don't know if I'm getting at you.
I think the discrepancy is that sometimes in poor communities, doctors have very, very big warehouses of drugs that they can give away.
Right.
So you wouldn't pick that up from a pharmacy refill, and there would be a disconnect if
right.
you were trying to do the comparison between the mother says, I got it, but there's no pharmacy refill.
Right.
So the question would be, mother, where did you get it from? Not just did you have it, but did you get it from?
No, I don't think that was that. And that was one of those limitations that I put down. Yeah, good point.
Well, other things that dovetail on that, and not only with the rest, is medication share.
Yeah, that was a limitation that I put down, because there's just, we know that happens, right?
Like they may be unafraid to. I have a question about the health police related to the presentation. So knowing what you know now related to health police, what suggestions do you have for medical providers or people who are working in the field on how to address some of these issues?
Good question, Kate. Thanks,
good
Kate. Well, I mean, I was struck. I really was struck in terms of, at least in terms of looking at those beliefs that are associated with the outcomes. Those three are related to how difficult it is to get my child to take the medication. Now, do I have any concrete ways of addressing that? I don't know, motivational interviewing, trying to, you know, in terms of approaches, or trying to understand, you know, I guess I'd start just trying to understand what that is. What does that mean? What are the issues? I think we know, and I know this from other questions that we asked on that questionnaire, these families lead incredibly complex lives with all kinds of contextual factors that are important that we know relate to outcomes too. I mean, it's financial hardships, et cetera, that they're dealing with. So whether it just becomes one thing in that list, that becomes difficult to address, and so it becomes hard to do it because I'm trying to deal with everything else. And so then it becomes an issue of trying to address some of the other stressors, I think. And yeah.
I have another question for Dr. Berry. What suggestions might you have in a way to incorporate follow-up? Because I'm also seeing from the public health ring, we're not only the smoking aspect, but because you're also a lactation specialist, women may leave the hospital breastfeeding, but communities where I've been, and they have no support if they call back to the postpartum unit after they get home and have some breastfeeding issues. So what kind of mechanism, maybe because this is a public health arena, community health, can we have hospitals establish some kind of a community health arm where then they can have nurses who receive those referrals and do that follow-up for the smoking, for the breastfeeding, or whatever else issues? Because you are so right. Nurses are very good at checking the boxes, but there is that gap in follow-up.
We do have a callback system. Right now, it's not that good. But there's a callback system for, we're not in the smoking, but for the breastfeeding. It's not 100% going, it's not going that well right now. But we're also in partnership with the WIC and the Gateway Consortium. And they do call back. There's support groups out there. I do some callbacks, but it's not 100%. But we do have a system in place. And if I do get to implement this protocol, I think I'm going to. I'm going to get support. With this protocol in place, there will be follow-up. Does that answer your question?
Well, I was just more thinking of the mechanisms, but you talked about an alliance with WIC.
Oh, we do have a list of numbers that we give the patients for callback. That's with breastfeeding.
Because in the old days, you know, you'd send out that public health nurse referral.
Yes.
And
but we do have a list of numbers
to
give
that. And that's almost a non-existent thing.
Yeah, because there's a lot of cutbacks on, you know,
right.
There's a lot of cutbacks on a lot of stuff.
Me?
Yeah.
A couple of things. One, it's really, I want to reflect on this issue of smoking during pregnancy, and that we've been pretty successful in getting women to stop smoking during pregnancy. And I wonder if they really get enough positive feedback and reinforcement that that's a really good thing, and if they actually then can see forward to the future in terms of how much this could benefit their children. Because it's an asthma trigger, too. So, I mean, the smoking goes across many, many different concerns that we have as nurses. And I just think we emphasize that, the doctors, the nurses, everybody focuses on not smoking during pregnancy. But it really, we need to broaden our horizon. We need to take some of these lessons and really move this along the continuum of health beyond the baby being born. As you mentioned, that I'm kind of shocked that people have been not smoking for maybe 8-9 months, or just pick up and smoke a cigarette. I just sort of almost can't imagine it. So I think that it's really something that's quite profound, and we should think about the success in this and how we can broaden the success to pediatrics and asthma and, just all going forward. And the other thing I wonder is to what degree people really realize that they've made progress, and what are we using to show them that, in fact, progress is being made in the things that they're doing, like improving how they use medications, and that there might be some repercussions from that would be visible, that you might see as a nurse, but that they perhaps aren't seeing. And to what degree in our work we can connect the behavior change with an outcome and make that visible to people so that they can say, wow, 6 months ago, we had a lot of problems, and now we're really not. And I can see that. And, that really reinforces then the kind of behavior that we can see. But I really think that we should take a harder look at how we can move ahead with this and get people to incorporate learning from what maybe we see as researchers or we see as practitioners in their own lives and use that to motivate them.
I think we have to change provider practice. Everybody thinks that they're too busy to do this, that, and the other thing. But
to work.
Yeah, but in fact, it's the encouragement that makes a difference for whatever age group you're working with, and they will come back.
Yeah, and I'll just add on to, I think that point is excellent. And if you look at those outcome expectancy beliefs, and that may be one way of really trying to get that. Look over the past 2 months when you know that they're adhering or whatever. Look to see what happened. And perhaps you could change those outcome expectancies. Because I was struck by those too in terms of, at least a third said it's not going to make any difference at all. Well, if you could work with those moms and try to show that there is a difference.
We do need a collaborative. We need a collaboration. Public health nurses, hospital nurses, outreach, the support groups. With that collaborative effort, we can say that we're doing something. But if A doesn't know what B is doing, B doesn't know what C is doing, and we're not measuring, we really cannot tell. Because as I'm saying, that we do collect the data, and I really couldn't say where the data is, but I know we collect it. I went, I was all over trying to find out where is this data. We're collecting it. We are collecting it. Where is it? So how can we measure? So that's interesting. So I guess having a protocol in place and the collaborative effort, we might be getting some of these. Because if you don't measure, you're just not sure where the success is. You wouldn't know what the numbers are.
And one other question on your issue with breastfeeding and smoking, it seems like if there were any way to fund the follow-up of breastfeeding and support through breastfeeding in the way that you showed for smoking, and you could do breastfeeding and smoking follow-up by phone.
Exactly.
That really would be great, because that might be something that, that is really considered. Everybody wants to improve breastfeeding. We know support is necessary. It could be that tying those two together, there would be a table. It could be funded, and then you could refer back to the OBGYN can for the mother, and sort of give a little report on the breastfeeding, give a little report.
Exactly. As you're saying that, this is something else, though. I became the lactation consultant in 2008. Our breastfeeding risk was 5.3%. It's now in the 30s. We make some highlights in New Jersey. I just attended a conference in Trenton, that's head office, to find out how our breastfeeding rates have climbed. We're going to be on the cover of Advance magazine next month because of the rates that's went up, but that's aside. So we have made progress. We have made progress.
I'm just thinking that in the way we talk in terms of collaboration, and you mentioned WIC and so forth, with MIC now you have men in clinic, they're involved, and this is one of the areas that we should really get them involved, because if they're in their homes, there's a form of support, and they should be, informed about the negative effects of smoking and also promoting breastfeeding in their homes. So we can probably use them in the clinics as well to get the message over to the women and to also be a support for them. And in the subways, we see all those posters about, particularly when I always look at the woman who has lost the digits on her fingers because of smoking. Why can't we have a young woman who stopped smoking, during pregnancy, and she has decided, well, after pregnancy, I'm definitely going to stop. That's one way of encouraging others not to go back to smoking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the media has a very good influence over anything. Just getting
the right
to, yes.
In Memphis, we have a breastfeeding group that's been working for 3 years. And what they did was have this incredible portrait of a mom, a dad, the mom's breastfeeding the baby, she's African American, and a little child looking on. But it's obvious that she's breastfeeding, and it has been on billboards, it's been on the bus stops, because we don't have subways. And it has turned our city around as far as breastfeeding, and it's the most positive, wow, I'd like a family.
I had to change the culture. In fact, I'm still fighting with the culture. I would like to really get close to the media to have that breastfeeding captured up there. But right now I'm in the process of 100% changing
the
media.
Any other questions? Please join me in thanking our three presenters.